This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A new poll shows Tom Foley with a big lead in the race for governor. But what exactly is this poll again? The Working Families Party and Chris Dodd endorsed Dan Malloy. No big surprise there. And Bill Curry says his party has lost its soul. Those are just a few of the stories that we'll tackle this week on The Wheelhouse. It's our weekly news roundtable. As always, you can join us 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. As always, we're joined by Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Bill Curry is here. He's our political analyst, and he wrote a new piece for Salon this week that's got a lot of people talking. My party has lost its soul, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and the victory of Wall Street Democrats. Hi there, Bill.
Great to be here, John.
Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, joins us as well. Hi there, Paz.
I understand NPR is going to use Bill's piece to raise money among the corporate community.
Oh, yes. We'll see how that goes.
This is my last visit, so I just want to say what a thrill it's been all these years.
We'll hold off, and we'll save that conversation for later on. And Jennifer Swift is with us. She's state political reporter for Connecticut Magazine. She writes a new blog on this year's election called Divided Connecticut. Hi there, Jennifer.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Now, we thought that we might start off with news of that poll today that we talked about, but something happened yesterday that just rose to the top of our list. It seemed like a standard campaign event, a candidate using the backdrop of a closing paper mill to talk about the business unfriendly practices of the current governor. And then everything just went terribly, terribly wrong. Let's listen.
Let's try and make this a state that is more welcoming and accommodating to employers and their needs. As governor, I'll be able to do that. I have a business background.
You have not reached out to
the
company.
Are you a member of the press?
I am the first selectman of Sprague.
Okay, well,
and so I know, I actually know, but you readily admit that you did not reach out to the first selectman of town. You readily admit all of those things
I know
because
it,
we're
I know
all.
That's when we should have had the help.
The understanding of. We'll agree to disagree on this one, but I think it's policy.
I didn't
invite you or these people.
Understood.
Or
we didn't invite you either. But we're here to talk to you because we want to hear what you have to offer.
You as a local leader, ma'am, I'm surprised you're not accepting more responsibility for this. Responsible leaders accept responsibility and accountability.
And you
had something to do with this.
You
had something to do with this. So to sit here and blame it, go ahead, blame it on everybody else.
What would you do if I came to you?
Okay, that's just a little montage drawn from a 30-minute press conference, and this was a video that was put up online by state Democrats. Usually it's the sort of thing that they would spend some time cutting into little punchy sound bites, but they just sort of ran the entire thing because it somewhat speaks for itself. Mark Pazniokas, you were there. Can you explain what exactly was going on?
Wow.
Oh, thank
trick,
you.
Trick question.
I know what Tom Foley wanted to do, but when I was leaving the state capitol yesterday, I ran into a Democratic staffer who asked me where I was going. I said, Tom Foley's doing a press conference outside a closing paper mill. And then this person just said, Tom Foley's going to a mill to make a point. This whole thing went off the tracks from the moment he arrived. And I don't mean to be petty, but, you know, optics do count in this business. And if you're showing up in Sprague, Connecticut, you know, one of Connecticut's really struggling towns, it's probably best that you not be deposited at the factory gate from the back seat of a BMW sedan.
Perhaps. Okay. So
optics
lesson number
aside.
One.
Well, he came thinking this was a great place to bang away at the governor over corporate welfare, over the governor's economic development policies. And you know what? That's a great issue. There's a lot to chew over from the left and the right, actually. But this probably wasn't the place for that. The wounds were still fresh here. 140 people just found out they're losing their jobs. And in a town the size of Sprague, they have two big employers. This was one of them. So he was ambushed, basically, by Kathy Austin, who is a Democrat supporter of Governor Malloy. She is the first electwoman of Sprague. She also is a state senator. And what I probably also should have mentioned in my story is she's a former prison guard and a union leader. So she is one tough cookie. And she let Foley speak for 3-4 minutes, and then she just lit into him. And what was supposed to be a very tightly scripted, short press availability. I mean, Foley's press advisory made that clear. He was only going to be there for 6.5 minutes or something, and he ended up slugging it out with her and with some very angry company employees for better of a half an hour.
Well, let me turn to you, Colin. Let's go back to the original idea here again. And Paz made reference to this, and maybe we can make sure that people understand what we're talking about here. Tom Foley, the last time he ran, everyone who ran against him ran a series of ads about how he helped to close a mill and put people out of work in Georgia. And now he goes to a plant that's closing to have the same sort of conversation. Right there, there's sort of a little bit of a red flag that might go up around some campaign staffers.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, these devastating commercials were run against him by one of his opponents last time around that did show these people. And it's always bad when the thing against you is a little bit euphonious. And so you had all these people going, he bankrupted the Bib, you know, and that just that was the kind of thing
Bib company,
that kind of stuck. Yeah, that was this Bib company. And what happened here happens a lot in campaigns. You show up, the candidate shows up with a thimble full of information. In other words, he doesn't really know very much about this paper plant. I think he admitted it's in Paz's story. He hadn't really done a close analysis of why this paper plant had closed. So he's got about a post-it worth of information about this. He wants to make a certain point. Apparently his current sort of the arrow that he's shooting at Malloy right now is that this is a business-unfriendly state, and so businesses either leave or want to leave, and then the Malloy administration bribes them to stay with this other money. And he's sort of suggesting – and it's not an unreasonable point. I mean, it's a semi-interesting argument. Why not have a somewhat more business-friendly climate so you're not constantly having to – with large sums of money, attempt to, quote unquote, bribe businesses to stay. But the whole thing was so poorly thought out for all the reasons that Paz has said. And I mean, I think you're also seeing a little bit of the Malloy campaign strategy right here, which is basically, I mean, there are going to be Indian raids when you do stuff like this. I'm sure they were quite aware of who was going to be showing up. These people were not just walking their dogs. You know, it was a disaster.
I will attest to that. These people did not happen by.
Well, they didn't happen by, but I think one of the optical problems, Jennifer Swift, in this entire thing is that Tom Foley shows up at what is a press event, but it's out in a field outside a plant, and other people are going to show up. And the way that you talk to ordinary people, people showing up maybe who have union ties or people who are first selectmen, former prison guards, these are all the sorts of people that you need to know how to talk to out in the world, not just people like Paz who show up for every press conference that's in Sprague, Connecticut. And that's, I think, part of the optical problem he created for himself yesterday.
Yeah, I agree. And I have to admit, I wasn't there yesterday, but I did see the half-hour video that the Democrats put out about this. And I think you can just tell from the tone of how the entire thing was going that it really got away from him. And that then, you know, when he was speaking to all of these different people that were there and he was speaking to the first select woman, it devolved from something where he was trying to blame everything on the governor to you had something to do with it. And you could tell that as it kept going on, it just got away.
And this is what we heard. He's blaming the workers. He's blaming the local town officials, Paz. These are the sorts of people I don't think you necessarily want to blame as you're casting around for independents and unaffiliates to vote for you in November.
In the end, he also was defending the private investment firm that made the decision to close the doors because he said companies don't close plants like this unless they're not working. You know, the locals were saying that this is really an asset sell-off. And that's not a place you want to be in either. Standing, you know, facing workers who are losing their jobs, telling them it's their fault and that, you know, the absentee mill owners who are investors in L.A., Paris and New York were right because he understands that. You don't want to jump on their side of the fence in the middle of a campaign.
And that's pretty much what you do when you even decide, as my point before, Bill, to just do this press event in the first place. You put yourself in a situation where you can only possibly be on the side of the investors who shut down plants.
You know, a couple quick points, the first of which is that on both sides of the political divide, an overbelief in mere thematics and atmospherics, in memes and slogans is often their undoing. This was a thematically really good idea, but it, for him on some level, but some sense of the emotional content of it and a much greater mastery of the specifics would have helped him out a lot in that situation. This isn't all just about marketing. The second thing, though, I disagree a little bit with what I've heard here. I don't think anybody came out of this covered in glory. I'm not sure how many votes the governor picked up by putting that unedited tape on. And I'm just saying two things. That first of all, it is clear on the one hand that Foley is not the right messenger for two of the biggest themes he's pursuing, which are political corruption and the over-reliance on corporate welfare as an economic development strategy. Those are two very resonant themes and problems all over America, and they are here. I just don't see this as the guy to make that case for a lot of the reasons that Paz and Colin and Jennifer touched on. And secondly, he's not the best person delivering any message yet. And this isn't his first time to the rodeo. This is his second time. And there's some of these things that I thought he'd be better at by now. Right. On the other hand, I just want to say one thing about the response, which is that, you know, it used to be – this has changed. Someone could come to somebody else's press conference and take notes. And then they could come and lobby reporters after the event. And then they could come and ask a question and maybe even contest one answer. But it's not that a press conference is like – it's not like coming to somebody else's press conference is barging into a dinner party uninvited. But there is a certain civility and protocol that is required. And I think that when you're shouting over – I think what most people saw was two partisan sides both trying to politicize an issue. I'm not sure anybody scored a lot of points.
But Dan Malloy wasn't there shouting, and it was a surrogate to be sure. But I think the optics, the video, was unflattering.
I
want to hear from Colin.
Wait, we're talking over each other. Wait a minute.
We don't want to do that, Colin.
I go a little further than that and say I think the other problem here is that the person that he's engaged in this battle with is a woman, and women are the key to this election, as they are to many elections. He also needs to prove that he's not a guy who gets angry and angry at women. That's sort of a little bit a part of his past, and it started to resemble a Rick Lazio moment. Remember when Lazio kind of crossed the stage at Hillary Clinton? And the person he really reminded me of the most, unfortunately for him, in recent news is ESPN Stewart A. Smith, who was
Stephen Smith.
Who recently suggested that the wives of NFL players should make sure that they're not doing things that make the NFL players want to knock them unconscious and drag them by the hair out of elevators. You know, and when you start blaming people for their troubles, even if he probably had a better argument than Mr. Smith did, when you start blaming people for their troubles and when you're a man sort of telling a woman, it's your fault, you screwed this up, you're the first electman of Sprague, you know, you did something wrong. And not to boil it all down to optics and stagecraft, but this is bad, bad, bad.
Well, one of the things that we picked up on a couple of weeks ago is when Tom Foley put out his first ad, there was this little slogan at the end of it, and we weren't sure if it was an official campaign slogan. He said, nobody should be doing better than right here in Connecticut. We tried to figure out what exactly that mean. Now, means. Our producer Tucker Ives has been listening to a lot of Tom Foley. He's picked up on maybe another theme that's been coming through. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said yesterday.
You readily admit that you did not reach out to the first selectman of town. You readily admit all of those things
why
that you didn't.
I?
Okay, so he says, why should I? Why should I?
That was a bad moment.
here's Foley last September when being asked about campaign financing.
Why should I pay for my own campaign? Well, I know I can, but why should I?
And Tucker picked up on this idea of, and we've heard this on more than one occasion, Paz, you go to an awful lot of these press conferences, why should I answer that question? Why should I do this? Why should I do that? It's not necessarily the most flattering or gubernatorial thing to be saying.
Why should I respond to you right now?
I think we need to interview his fourth grade teacher. I just feel like this has been around for a while.
Jennifer, I mean, you cover a lot of these things too. I mean, the message that Tom Foley is getting across, Colin just said it, he's trying to in his commercials, he's trying to come across a certain way to women who are going to be very key to this upcoming election, to unaffiliated voters. After what happened yesterday, after a lot of the messaging that he has been giving and a lot of the things, frankly, he's not been saying on the campaign as far as answering questions, do you think that he's making anything clearer for people who maybe don't know enough about Tom Foley or might be looking for a reason to like him?
No, I think one of the biggest criticisms so far has been that he's been very vague. And if you're trying to get, 6,404 people to vote for you, you should be telling them why they should be doing that and not turning it on them and, or on other people asking why he should be telling you something. And I think people are really asking him for a lot of specifics on his plans and what do you mean when you say that and why are you doing this? And when you come back with that flippant question, I don't think you're really getting that across.
And I know your colleague Keith Vanniff wrote another one of his big budget pieces this week in the Connecticut Mirror, Paz, talking about the specifics and whether or not Tom Foley will eventually come out with some specifics about his budget plans, his economic plans. Are we going to see these?
I don't think so. I think the lesson that Tom Foley took away from the 2010 race is that specifics get you in trouble. He was far more specific with Keith in 2010, laying out his approach to the budget. And, you know, there was some blowback on that. This time around, he clearly, I believe, is, you know, skating as far above the specifics of issues as he can. Anybody who saw that debate, and probably a quarter of the audience is in this room right now, but anybody who saw the one—
I was on vacation.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, there we go.
Sorry.
But I think, you know, it got a
make
one—
Make it a fifth.
please, you saw it, right? Okay, Colin. All right, three out of the five. But— You know, he clearly has a strategy of I am not going to answer, even to the point that it looks kind of comical. You know, when you're asked about specifics of the Newtown gun control bill, you know, Mr. Foley, do you believe restricting magazines to no more than 10 rounds? I said, you know, I won't comment. You know, I said, you know, I asked him after that debate, will you enumerate any specific about that bill that you like or dislike? And he just said, no.
Well, but if why should I is actually a theme that we're going down. Bill, you know, you've run for governor before. I mean, why should he? Why should he answer the questions? He may get elected in November. We're going to talk about the poll coming up next without ever answering any of these questions from dummies like us.
First of all, the why should I has a certain arrogant tone to it. I mean, you could actually ask someone, why should I do this now, and follow it up with an argument and have an interesting conversation on most times. But if you simply fire off, well, why should I, it doesn't sound right. It goes back. I remain unconvinced. I think that these were mixed optics. I think that I mostly agree this was a botched thing on his part. I think he could go to charm school for a year, and if he wants to go to Sprague and defend the company, he's not the guy to prosecute this case. I think that if he thought that John Rowland never did anything wrong, as he said 5 years after he'd come out of prison, then he's not the guy to prosecute a public corruption case. He has problems as a candidate. I think he carries himself a little better than he did last time, but that's not enough. It comes down to specifics. Every blueprint, every vision needs a blueprint. And the lesson he could have learned about specificity is that it works for you if you did your homework. Specificity will screw you up if you don't know what you're talking about. He decided not to be specific as opposed to doing the reading. And I think that's where his mistake is.
We're talking with Bill Curry. He's our political analyst, and he's got a big piece in Salon this week about Democrats losing their soul. We'll be talking about that later on in the program. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Jennifer Swift, state political reporter for Connecticut Magazine. She's got a brand new series and blog on this year's election called Divided Connecticut. And Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, is here. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a poll that shows Tom Foley's actually up by 9 points over Dan Malloy. We're going to consider what this poll exactly means coming up next on The Wheelhouse, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so that means The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're talking with Jennifer Swift from Connecticut Magazine and the blog Divided Connecticut, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Bill Curry, our political analyst, who has a big piece in Salon this week, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on the show today, Colin?
You know, for once, we're doing a perfect segue from The Wheelhouse to my show. We're talking about politics on The Wheelhouse. We're talking about hell on my show. We're going to look at sort of the theological – actually, in particular, sort of the idea that young people today say if they were going to make up a religion, it wouldn't have a hell, but because it just doesn't make any sense to them. But hell persists. Hell's been kind of grandfathered in.
Okay. So hell this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. That should be fun. We saw a poll this week, the YouGov poll in partnership with the New York Times. It shows that Tom Foley, with a lead of 42% to Dan Malloy's 33% in a potential rematch of the governor's race 4 years ago. That's a pretty healthy lead, Colin. We looked at this poll and we said, well, okay, this may tell us something. It may not. We're going to get to a poll expert in just a moment. What did this say to you?
Well, it actually said to me that we need to report polling differently. I'm going to use a visual aid here, which is always helpful on radio. I'll hold it up to the microphone so that people at home can see it. The Hartford Courant ran this over the fold as far up on the page as they possibly could. It says that big headline says, poll shows Foley well ahead. And then there's this little tiny headline that's much smaller that says, online methodologies accuracy questioned. Consult your physician if you have flushing, blushing, high stool, or other symptoms as a result of reading this poll. So, it you know,
that Flomax poll is actually is not something that we should talk about.
So you look at that and you think, well, is this a story or isn't it? And if it's a story, should it be on page one above the fold? And I think what we're seeing here, first of all, is that polling is changing. You're going to hear this over and over again in this segment. The whole industry of polling is changing. Methodologies are changing. And one of the things that you'll see more and more is the so-called suite of polls. At least Stravinsky composed the first one, I think. But suite of polls where you take a whole bunch of polls and you Nate Silver them, right? You crunch them down and you sort of average them out and you kind of try to figure out what the real truth is. The truth doesn't lie in any one particular poll. It lies in this extracted or extruded product that comes from a whole bunch of polls. But I think that's a great argument for not reporting polls as news. You know, maybe there should be a little area of your website or your newspaper or your magazine, whatever it is you've got, where it's almost like more like a column. Like, this is the latest snapshot. It's how it fits in with the other data. You know, it's data. Data isn't necessarily a story. You know, that kind of thing. I think the day of reporting this like it's really big news, I don't know whether it's true or not. We're going to get into the methodology and the nuts and bolts of it here, but reporting it like it's big news seems very misleading.
Let's go to somebody who knows about these things. Scott Keeter is director of survey research for Pew Research Center. Joins us by phone today. Scott, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm wondering what you can tell us about a poll like this YouGov poll, an online poll that's different from the traditional polls like the one we use here, the Quinnipiac poll in the state all the time, or the ones that you conduct. What's the big difference? What should we be looking for?
Well, there are really two big differences that are worth pointing out. One of them is that the YouGov poll is conducted entirely online. So it's only among people who have access to the Internet. Now, the good news is that nationally that number is 89% of the public. So you're not missing a whole lot of people. And my guess is that in Connecticut that number is probably even higher given the education level and affluence of the population in the state. But you are missing some people, particularly older people, less educated people, poorer people. So there's a bias in any online-only poll. The bigger difference, though, between the YouGov polls and the kinds of polls that Quinnipiac does or that Pew Research has traditionally done is that the sample is what's called an opt-in sample. People volunteer to be participants in YouGov's polls. I'm a member of their panel myself, and you know, probably a lot of your listeners are as well. By contrast, when we do a telephone poll, we call you up, and the call comes out of the blue. You know, a lot of people refuse to talk to us. A lot of people are hard to reach, and so it's not a perfect methodology, but the fact is you don't get to choose whether you're going to be contacted for our polls. And that particular feature of polling, since its invention back in the 1930s, has been the statistical foundation of the estimates that we make, being able to say that the sample that we got is representative of the population with a margin of error of plus or minus 3% or whatever it happens to be. So this is extremely controversial in the polling world right now, and the fact that the New York Times and CBS decided to switch or at least to add to their polling YouGov polls at this point is very, very big news.
Of course, one of the things that has changed, not just the penetration of Internet into people's homes, but also the fact that traditional method that you've always used of calling up people, that doesn't work quite so well in a world in which most of us are getting rid of our landline phones left and right. I mean, this is another variable thrown into all this that's changed so much in the last couple of years. I would think, Scott, that it's completely altered the landscape for polling like this.
Well, it certainly has. I mean, it's funny, even as early as 2004, we were getting a lot of questions from people saying, you know, my kids only have a cell phone, and so you're not able to cover them in your polls. And that was true at that time. But beginning in 2008, we have called cell phones as part of our samples. And in fact, our polling today is 60% cell phone, 40% landline. And we have found in tests, if we were only calling cell phones, we would actually have very, very good samples of the public because more people have a cell phone than a landline. So that problem is not is not really a problem for us anymore. We're able to take care of that. The thing that we're having trouble with are response rates. And right now, you know, if we get to double digits in a response rate in a telephone survey, we're doing pretty well. We're usually in the 7 to 9% range. And so a lot of people say, well, isn't that just like an opt-in survey because, you know, you're missing so many people? And all I can say is that our samples actually look like the public, and we can say that because we can compare it to census data. And the other thing we can say is that we continue to be able to do them in elections and forecast the outcome accurately. We did so in 2012. We did so in 2010 and 2008, and so do most other telephone polls.
We're talking with Scott Keeter. He's director of survey research for Pew Research Center. We're talking about a new YouGov poll, an online poll that came out in cooperation with the New York Times and CBS. It shows that Tom Foley is leading by some 9 points in the race for governor over Daniel Malloy. If you have thoughts, 860-275-7266. Jackie's calling from West Hartford. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind, Jackie?
Hi, well, I was calling about the poll, and it's interesting you just had your guest speak about that. Couple of things. I actually think that poll is accurate, and it would actually, I think, probably be even more skewed towards the Republicans if they had used the traditional methods, because, as you know, most folks that have landlines are older, whiter, and tend to vote Republican.
And tend to vote
so
more.
I think the method that was used is actually maybe underrepresenting the mood of the state. And I wanted to also ask the folks on your panel, what are their thoughts about the poll representing the economy? Because myself, I know I'm stressed about the economy. I'm stressed about my high taxes. I'm stressed about the fact that jobs aren't secure, salaries haven't gone up, and that we are, what, 48 out of 50 in job creation? And I know for myself, this has become a really tough place to live.
Well,
and I'd like to get your thoughts and your panel's thoughts on that. And
well,
I think personally, the Democrats have had years to make corrections, and we haven't had course corrections.
And Jackie, thank you for that, because I thank you for your phone call, and I do want to get some thoughts. I'll go to you first, Paz, on some of these things that she brings up. She thinks, first of all, that maybe this poll is accurate. It's accurately reflecting the way people feel right now, maybe about this governor's race, maybe a little bit about the economy, the state of Connecticut.
There's no question that the Democrats and Governor Malloy are vulnerable on the economy. It is an issue that there's been an alarming sameness to it for 20 years. This state has not had net job growth through various administrations. So there's no question there. But to go to the accuracy of the poll, I mean, this is really an experiment. We're going to have to see this repeated over and over again to know the accuracy, to know the reliability. And the problem in a political sense is polls often have real-time consequences. Now, fortunately for Governor Malloy and John McKinney, Mr. Foley's competitor for the Republican nomination, their campaigns are publicly financed. But 10 years ago, a headline like the one across the top of the Hartford Current would have been fatal. Yes, Mr. Curry seated to my left here. Because the money stops immediately. Now, it still has consequences in that it tells your base, or it can tell your base, that things are over, don't bother, don't show up. So if you were doing market research, if you were trying to determine, you know, long-term attitudes of where, you know, where are youth going politically, where are older people going, so forth, it's kind of a cool thing to see over time which methodology is best. But in the context of a campaign, these things for the candidates are pretty scary.
Wait, and I want to get Bill's thought in just a second, but Scott Keeter, I mean, what Paz just said and Colin's idea that perhaps this sort of polling means a different sort of reporting on polling, that we need to not be treating these polls as they come out as the news events that we long have, because they do have such real-time impact and they can only really be taken in account over the course of time with a lot of other data coming in. Do you agree with that basically, Scott?
Well, there's some wisdom in that, I think. You know, we do polling not to forecast who's going to win or lose. We do it to help explain the thinking of the public. Now, in order to be taken seriously, you have to have some measure of accuracy of your polling, and that's why pollsters care about whether they get it right or not. But the point of a poll really is to help us understand why people think what they do and who supports a candidate. And so, you know, I've always hoped that the news coverage of our polling would be more on the meaning of the election, and that's what we spend our time trying to explain rather than sort of who's up, who's down. But the fact is, we're all political junkies. We love, you know, we love the horse race. It's just that in the case of the Connecticut race, as far as I know, you actually don't have very many, you haven't had very many polls. I think Quinnipiac's last poll was in May. So this YouGov number is the only one that's out there for people to chew on, and it's going to, you know, it's going to generate a lot of heat.
When we were talking before, Bill, when Paz mentioned this, I mean, yes, you ran for governor. Polls are very, very important. It sometimes can have a big impact. I wanted you to weigh in quickly.
Just one. I mean, the problem with predicting the future is that it's chock full of stuff that hasn't happened yet. And we look, you know, we ask more of these polls than they can ever give us. This was a bad day for John McKinney, who may be the stronger candidate in that Republican field. But in addition to the NRA and the establishment being against him and the name recognition, now has to deal with this poll. I think that was its greatest impact. You know, in 2012, Democrats all said that the Republican pollsters were just another example of Republicans being anti-science. They'd gotten the race so badly. In 2010, those same Republican pollsters got the race right and the Democrats got it wrong. Because there's an element of art in almost all of this, as Scott said, of self-selection. There's a bit of it. There's weighting that pollsters do. They make a prediction as to what turnout's going to be like, which is the central issue. From this year, it really is the central issue, I think. And so the question here is who's coming and whether or not that sample reflects not the overall census but the turnout on election day. I think Foley probably is up a little bit in this race, not by 9 points.
I just want to – I have a question for Scott, actually, but I just want to sort of reinforce what Bill says. I think, you know, if you don't really pay too much attention to this, one of the mistakes you might make is to assume that any poll that you read involves people being called and their answers being written down and then everything gets added up and you just sort of get that as raw data. And, in fact, these polls are weighted. They're weighted scientifically to sort of really kind of anticipate what actual electoral behavior is going to be. So it's never pure. YouGov is kind of a new animal, and it's done a lot of work overseas initially. They've been very effective at predicting the winners of X Factor. The difference, of course, being that people –
although you've been great at that as
right.
well. So you're just doing it on intuition.
The point I was going to make is that people actually care more about their X Factor vote than they often do about their political vote. But Scott, one of the things that I read – and I don't know how much you know about YouGov and how they operate. But one of the things that I read – I think Mark Blumenthal was writing about this, saying that one advantage that they may have is that these people who are in their pool, this essentially self-selected pool – they sort of have – they have a lot of data about these people because the people have been in the pool for a long time. It's not a cold call. It's actually part of the statistical sampling that they have. So just in the same sense that, you know, as we're all sort of dimly aware, Google knows, you know, that we like broccoli or something like that. I mean, I'm wondering how much big data YouGov has and whether your understanding is that they will then use this in a kind of longitudinal way. In other words, sort of over time, we'll be looking at respondent X and attempting to predict some of respondent X's behavior in terms of going to the poll or whatever based on stuff that they already know about respondent X.
That's a very positive thing about the YouGov method and indeed about any panel where you're able to accumulate a lot of information about people, particularly if you can keep them in long enough to follow them over time, because one thing you can do is you can match their data to the actual public voting records that indicate whether a person turned out in a previous election or not. That's a very powerful thing, and YouGov's been in this business quite a long time in the U.S., and they've made lots of forecasts in elections, and generally their track record is quite good. And so in that sense, I think that, you know, the New York Times, in picking them to be a partner in CBS, you know, went with probably the best of the available polls of that type. They do have this benefit of knowing a lot about people, and I think that potentially does make their polling more accurate. You know,
Scott,
again, I think this is a big change for polling, and we're all trying to absorb the implications of it.
Scott, quick question: should we view them as a true poll or something between a poll and a focus group?
No, it's a poll. It's definitely a poll. You've got gigantic sample sizes. People are interviewed individually. They're not communicating with each other. It's just a different animal because, number one, it's done online, and number two, it's not a random sample of the public. It's very heavily statistically modeled, more so even than the random samples that we collect. Even though we do weight the data to try to make them match the public better, this is subjected to quite a bit more of that kind of thing.
Scott Keeter is Director of Survey Research for the Pew Research Center. We got to have you back and talk more about these polls sometime, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure.
Before we take our break, I just want to turn to Jennifer Swift quickly. You know, the blog that you're writing for Connecticut Magazine, it's called Divided Connecticut. We look at poll results like this, and we also look at endorsements like the Working Families Party deciding to endorse Governor Malloy, something Jonathan Pelto isn't all that happy about. The fact that this poll, for instance, doesn't really take into account Jonathan Pelto or Joe Visconti, the Republican who's trying to get on as an independent in November. Because I'm just wondering, as you thought about putting together this project called Divided Connecticut, how do you feel like we're divided right now? I mean, what's the division that you see?
Well, when we say Divided Connecticut, we're not just talking blue and red, just when it comes to the election. We're really focusing on a lot of data, on a lot of policy, and seeing where are we divided in our cities, where are we divided when it comes to things like education, crime. You mentioned the Working Families Party. How is something like the Working Families Party going to be divided, or are they going to be divided as we head toward November? Which way are these wedges, not just education, but all of these different policy things, really going to affect how these parties are divided going forward? Is it going to split something like the Democratic Party? Is it going to split any of these other really?
And as you look at this, how much do you think that people are paying attention to some of the issues that you're trying to pull apart? I mean, we try to drag our conversation on our program on a daily basis back to the issues. And then one day a week, we end up talking an awful lot about the horse race and the politics of it. An awful lot of that horse race comes into just what we talked about off the front. What are these people like? Do we want this person versus this person to lead? And that doesn't really get into some of the divisions over issues. It really just gets into some of the base reasons why people go to the polls in the first place. I like this guy. I don't like that guy.
Right. I mean, and we launched a site in the middle of July, leading up to an election. Do people really care about politics in a governor's race that's happening in November, in July? And we're trying to balance it, I think, a little bit. I think part of the reason why something like, the Hartford Current will put a poll on the front page is because we know people do want to know. They want to be able to gauge this race, but we also want to be able to balance it with a little bit of policy. And I think sometimes, meeting those two is a little bit hard, but I think people do want to know, the basic facts about each candidate. Where do they stand on these issues, and not just here's what, all your neighbors think about these people.
Jennifer Swift, a state political reporter for Connecticut Magazine. They've got a new blog on this year's election called Divided Connecticut. Also joining us, Mark Pazniokas. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Bill Curry is here. His new piece for Salon is titled My Party Has Lost Its Soul, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Victory of Wall Street Democrats. I'll be back with Colin McEnroe to talk about that piece and some of the ideas that Bill has about his party. Coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, just can't get enough of Bird Note? Well, we're going to have a whole hour for the birds. We'll be joined by bird lovers and bird experts to discuss the state of the bird population in Connecticut. We're going to answer your burning bird questions, not how to burn a bird, but actually the burning questions.
Really poorly put.
About birds. Hey, I didn't write this promo. I'm throwing somebody under the bus. Patrick Scahill, our science reporter, will stop by to talk about some big birds and some very small birds he's been reporting on. If you're a bird lover, you will want to join us on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're talking about some of the news of the week. And the big news for us this weekend is we all read on Sunday a fairly lengthy piece by Bill Curry in Salon. It's something that I know that we've been talking about an awful lot, Bill, since your very, very first appearance on this show some 8 years ago, talking about what the Democratic Party is really all about. This piece is called My Party Has Lost Its Soul, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Victory of Wall Street Democrats. All right, so your party's lost its soul. Can it get it back?
Sure. One of the things, whether we're talking about politics or the economy, the culture, we constantly talk about forces that are at work. And as soon as people start with globalization or decadence or whatever your perspective may be, and it's always a signal when people talk about forces that are at work that they're about to be passive and to throw up their hands and to not have a plan. We're much better when we talk about choices. My problem isn't globalization. My problem is the decisions we made around NAFTA. You can go piece by piece. If we had done a public option on health care, raised the minimum wage in 2009 when we had the votes, bailed out the homeowners instead of the banks, and just brought back our military profile just a smidge, there'd be no budget crisis. There'd probably be no Tea Party at all. And Barack Obama would be a folk hero rather than a punching bag. And so as we're talking about whether we're Foley and Malloy or any of these or any race, we focus too much on themes, too much on personalities, and not enough on the fundamental policy choices that I think actually drive the election.
And you say fundamental policy choices. What you say in this piece is essentially that those fundamental policy choices over and over again by your party, the Democratic Party, have been made on behalf of, let's just say, Wall Street versus Main Street, if that's a one glib way we can put it.
Look, I'd say two things. First of all, there's been a trend line at work here since for almost 40 years. It's a 30 years war plus. It began when Ronald Reagan – I was in the state Senate when Ronald Reagan won his first election, and we went from a very progressive institution to a very conservative institution overnight, and we were still Democratic. You could feel the change in the room instantly. And in Washington, they lost the Senate. Democrats lost the Senate, and they kept the House. But a guy named Tony Coelho, who was a California Democrat with deep Wall Street roots, took over fundraising and began a process of connecting the Democratic Party to Wall Street. I would argue that Coelho had more influence on the Democratic Party than Ronald Reagan had on the Republican Party. It changed the nature of this party in my lifetime. Bill Clinton was the first Democrat to ever outspend a Republican in an election for president. Barry Goldwater outspent Lyndon Johnson. We'd never come close. And Barack Obama was the first Democrat to outraise Republicans on Wall Street. And as a result, he has the most conservative economic policy appointments of any Democratic president since Grover Cleveland. That's not a throwaway line. I looked at it closely before I said it. And our party has been silent, and I'll just say one other thing. When you look at the two parties, this churning is going on. You see it in this race in Connecticut. All the old categories are defunct, and a new debate is in the process of being born. But let's just take a look at 2016. If it's Hillary and Rand Paul, I've got one candidate who's against a military force, against the surveillance state, and against crony capitalism, and then I have the Democrat. And I love Hillary, and I respect her very much. But this is – talk about the world turned upside down. And I think a lot of Rand Paul's arguments are specious. You can see these things here. This is changing. What's happening? The Republicans are having a policy conference every week. They're going after their incumbents from every side. They're having a death match. And we're not even having a conversation.
And as you say, there's think tank after think tank on various sides of the Republican
they're
or
all
conservative
doing that.
Party.
And we have one think tank that serves our establishment, almost no public debate. And the last primary challenge was Ned Lamont against Joe Lieberman 8 years ago in the U.S. Senate. This isn't about not only is the question of soul, this is a zombie party walking through a very dangerous moment in time.
Colin?
Well, I mean, I think you see this here in Connecticut, and Bill and I talk about this a lot, but when I'm walking my dogs at night, I do the soul searching almost every night now. Who am I going to vote for? In many respects, Dan Malloy has been a disappointment to me in a lot of the ways that Bill's talking about. He is so close to being what I would sort of consider to be a conventional pro-business Republican that, for example, John McKinney, as I wrote recently, should be checked periodically to make sure it's not actually Bill in some kind of John McKinney costume, because John McKinney's had to
you
run.
You saw that.
John McKinney's had to run a campaign that looks an awful lot like a Democrat's campaign. That's how much of an inversion there is going on here in Connecticut. I mean, Dan Malloy's obviously spent a lot of money and resources on, we keep saying this phrase today, a corporate welfare program. I think it crowds out a lot of other kinds of initiatives, and I think he's made a mockery of the clean election program that got him elected in the first place. And so what do you do? What does somebody who wants to vote that particular way, the way that Bill's talking about here in Connecticut, do? Do you vote for Jonathan Pell? What do you do, you know?
Well, right now, that's the thing, Mark Pazniokas. This time around, you may have a choice. You could vote for Jonathan Pelto, or if you feel more a Rand Paul sensibility on the Republican side, you might be able to vote for Joe Visconti as opposed to Tom Foley.
Yes. Neither Joe Visconti or Jonathan Pelto, I think, are sort of the true firebrands that Bill is talking about in the Republican Party, where you do have deep philosophical differences and you do have kind of a devil-may-care approach to it, saying we're about ideas and we're not as concerned about nominating somebody through a primary process who perhaps cannot win in November. That is one difference. You know, Bill in his piece talks about Ralph Nader a lot, and Nader has been trying to argue for years there's this left-right convergence. And quite frankly, I only see it on a few limited things, the so-called corporate welfare. You have criticism from the left and the right. I'm trying to think of some of the other
ones. Other one that Jennifer's written about, though, is Common Core, education.
Yeah, that was the other one I was trying to think of. I'm doing my Rick Perry moment. Yeah. Two things I can only think of.
And there's a third thing. But you write about education. This is one of those places where Ralph Nader writes about in his book Unstoppable, we've talked about. Bill certainly mentions it here, that on the right and on the left, there's an awful lot of fear about Common Core and what that means to education of my kids in my school. Maybe this is one of those issues where the left and the right, the far ends of the spectrum, come together.
Right. I do think that while education could be one of those issues, I don't know if it's going to be, you know, unequivocally that one issue that will get a lot of people to vote for these candidates on, you know, who are a little bit too far to the left or a little bit too far to the right. I don't know if they'll get enough of that because they're very issue oriented. But I do think that there are a lot of issues that we're seeing now that, you know, you have a lot of moms concerned about Common Core that are now going to be getting out into this political sphere where they might not have before. I don't know if that necessarily is going to be enough, though, to really have, you know, the fundamentals of each party change, or if this is just going to be one issue that they're going to have to deal with.
And maybe, Bill, it doesn't show up in the governor's race this time around, but you reference Ralph Nader in this left-right convergence. There are a few. Corporate welfare is one that Paz mentions. We certainly talk about education. We see more and more of these issues cropping up where I think parts of both parties are very unhappy with the way the corporatist center of the two parties are acting on an everyday basis.
There is. You know, when people hear the word populist, as I said in that piece, it's a word that's best used with conscious imprecision, and it generally denotes a sensibility. It's generally a negative. And again, if we step back from that, look at the underlying facts, it is about lower taxes on the one hand and much stronger confrontation of the concentration of power in big government and big business and in the corrupt relations that unite them. And these are not small issues. There aren't just a couple of these. I would just differ
right.
with different mark on
the
this.
The NSA and the Patriot Act, and nationally, there are a whole bunch.
They're huge. And even in this race,
I was talking Connecticut.
But in Connecticut, they're not. I don't think that. You know, who knows who the nominee will be? But property tax reform, opening up the state employee health care plan, public education, campaign finance, economic development policy, land use planning. These aren't small items. There is a fundamental churning it's not unlike when the Republicans were formed in 1856, the New Deal coalition in 1932, when Democrats lost the South in 1964. There's a massive churning going on. By the way, if I just make a shameless plug.
15 seconds to do it.
I'll be actually interviewing Ralph at the Mark Twain Memorial on August 14th on the article on the subject, and it should be an interesting evening for anyone who wants to and try to make it down to
We will put information on our website, WNPR.org, and we'll tweet out information. Bill Curry and Ralph Nader together in one place at the Mark Twain House. Read the piece in Salon, My Party Has Lost Its Soul, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Victory of Wall Street Democrats. Thanks to Bill Curry. Thanks to Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks to Jennifer Swift of Divided Connecticut and Connecticut Magazine. And thanks, as always, to Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.